This week on RSBNB Update, it's a scattershot ninja strike covering QOL changes to skilling and the Zamorak boss fight. We then go back in time to 2015 MassCab and have another look at RuneScape's first raid. This is RSBNB Update, episode 892, recorded Wednesday, July 20th, 2022. Raids, Death, and Taxes. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of RSBNB Update. Tanis is back again this week. Welcome back, Tanis. It's been a few weeks.
Thank you, Shane. Yes, unfortunately, I was very under the weather last week, and I am so happy and excited to be back today talking about a few, you know, fun patch notes and a little retrospective I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, that's right. And to to carry us through that retrospective, Thaxi is back with us because the retrospective we are going to be doing is about MassCab raids that came out in July 2015. 7 years ago at this point, and it's part of our Then and Now series looking at various pieces of RS content that either have changed in their perception and how they're carried out by players since then, or in the case of this one, actually, I think mainly in the case of this one, we just didn't have the breadth of our production team to do it justice back then in terms of the PVM side and whatnot. So we're going to have a look at that and have a look at where MassCab landed today. But it, of course, as Tanis mentioned, we do have a bunch of ninja strikes as well that we have to talk about this week. But if you're joining us for the first time, I can be found at Shane12088 in game. Tanis can be found at Tanis79, and Thaxi is Thaxi. And if you want full show notes, you can find those at update.show. And we're just going to begin with the ninja strikes this week because these are, once again, I feel like when we look at these ninja strikes, it's a fairly substantive collection of patches. And I know, Tanis, you and I have talked about this before, about whether or not the ninja strikes need to, in effect, be billed as their own update just because of what they do for the game.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if you notice, like, that's kind of went back and forth in its messaging, right? Like, there's been times when they were standalone and held up as you know, like a headline update, and then there are times, you know, where it's part of a, you know, it's just
part
a
of
little
an off
bit
week.
More, yeah,
it's
part
a
of an off
post.
Week, exactly.
Just, yeah, I mean, yeah. Oftentimes in the past they were just on the forums for many years. It was, you had to go to the forums and said, "Oh, there's a ninja patch this week," and the weekly update, and oh, hey, we've got these other things going, and quiet week, and you had to go to the forums to find those patch notes.
Yeah. So starting off, continuing the effort to modernize the UI, text in the login and lobby has been replaced with TrueType font, so it's more clear, easier to scale. Not much more to say on that. Then we get into the true side of the skilling business, starting off with the farming skill, of course. Leprechauns now confirm successful noting of produce by using items with an info box. Leprechauns and farmers now remain in place rather than wandering about the farm, as they have done for the better part of 17 years, I think. I think farming was 2005, July 2005, maybe. Or was it 2006? I don't know. It was a long time ago. I know we just passed the anniversary of it. It was 2005 because the farming seeds and equipment were the first update we discussed on the podcast.
Oh my gosh.
We're dating ourselves here. I'm dating myself. These two, I don't know what you guys were doing in 2005 RS related. But
not knowing it existed.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I played a little bit 2003, 2004, and then I think I didn't come back until 2007.
There you go. Farmers also now offer items for sale in a shop rather than through dialogue boxes. And farmers now have pay as their left click option rather than right click or needing to go through a dialogue on that. And see, these are just little things that you move and they improve quality of life on it. So
Yeah, I like how they make them stay put, like they're, you know, like they're Amazon workers or something. They're like, no,
no,
do not go away from your patch. You stand here.
That's the debate of, like, how much do we move away from having, like, an MMO, you know? It's like, this is massive multiplayer online, but is it a role-playing game versus, like, you know, this is an update that will be incredible quality of life. You do not lose incredible immersion by the fact that the farmer gets to sit. Like, in the original version, maybe they should have been sitting at, like, you know, a little farmer's stand or something, right?
Uh-huh.
Now they're just going to be standing there. But, like, in terms of the RPG aspect of it, they walked around because they were real living, breathing things.
Real living farmers.
And not just, yeah, and not just hotspots for selling things.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting.
Now there are agricultural slaves.
Lovely.
<Do it>.
Our quality of life.
Moving on to Pyramid Plunder. Instead of 3 to 4 entrances to Pyramid Plunder taking you to an empty tomb, all 4 entrances now take you to the Guardian Mummy. That's amazing.
How long has that been around? Like, we are at least 10 years past when that could have came in.
No. Yeah.
And here's one. Here's one. Players with 41 plus thieving entering Pyramid Plunder are now sufficiently stealthy to always avoid a random act of violence from its guardian mummy. The poor sarcophagus guy has a tendency to lash out, but he's been working on his mummy issues, the patch note says. And this leveling benefit is indicated in the thieving guide.
They used to add very, like, almost every patch note, like, anything that was substantive, they added some quip to it. I miss a lot of those quips. It's cool to see them ringing a couple of them back. It's a very RuneScape twist.
But 41...
Yeah, he used to punch you. 41 was the requirement to get in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And 41 is something that's so easily accessible, and when we start looking at Pyramid Plunder as a whole, this, I think, just...
I don't know, it's 21, isn't it?
Yeah, it's 21, so you got 20-odd levels, but that's really not that much in this day and age.
Punches you? No, it's... I mean, in Pyramid Plunder, that's still a couple hours at most.
Yeah, and, I mean, I'm trying to remember what I did on my alt to get to the first batch.
Doors.
Doors, right.
Doors in Thieves Guild. Thieving Guild, because that world-hopping... Speaking of QOL, hey, Jadak, cool down on those doors, please. You only needed to hop through like 4 or 5 worlds and then go back to your start, but still.
Yeah. And hey, I mean, what other MMO relies on that as a mechanic for skill training? I don't know.
But. I mean, well, I think that picking locks is a fairly consistent skill mechanic in a lot.
No, no, I mean hopping worlds.
Yeah, but not jumping worlds.
Oh, not server hopping? Yeah, no.
No.
That's a no.
Not a thing.
Converted various feedback messages in Pyramid Plunder to info boxes so that you get feedback if your chat is closed. This will be an interesting one. This might be an interesting one for you, Tanis, because if you were doing Pyramid Plunder, where would your magnifier be?
Oh.
Oh, it's right on the things that I'm clicking.
Okay, so that would that would work then. All right.
Yeah, good. On the urns and stuff. That's cool, actually. Yeah. That's a really good. I didn't even think about that.
Bladed dive and skilling tools. No, the skilling offhands from Krosis are not being augmentable yet, for anybody wondering on there. But the augmented crystal chime, chisel, hammer, knife, saw, tinderbox, enhanced pyromatic, hammertron, and sculpting chisels of all gods will now allow you to use bladed dive when wielded with laceration boots or an appropriate offhanded item. Yep. And catalyst fragments from Sliske's endgame now count as an offhand item for bladed dive, similar to skilling offhands. That took a while, but I know people have been wanting that since they run around with that while skilling.
Yep. I think a lot of people were asking for it to be like a... I'm muted. I think asking for it to be like a pocket slot item or something so they could...
Right.
I mean, the thing is that a lot of these are like the sculpting chisels, and those are still not augmentable, and sculpting chisels are two-handed, but thus the laceration boot change.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you want to have a wise perk on, which is arguably potentially better with another, you know, a hand available to you, maybe still better, but...
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
The agility obstacles in Het's Oasis are easier to tap on mobile, same... With Wisps, they maintain the same click box when turning into fountains. Bird snares are easier to tap on mobile, and Anachronia agility obstacles are also easier to tap on mobile. I feel like these ones are very important, given that we now know that 20% of RS players play exclusively on mobile.
Yeah, this is one that stood out to me, and I'm always in favor of making that hitbox, you know, easier to click.
Yeah.
And, you know, unfortunately, none of those activities actually affect me, because I ain't doing it laps at Anachronia. but I'm glad to see these kind of improvements, because I think in general it just improves the quality, you know, of the game.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Absolutely. All right. Moving on to the second week of Zamorak changes now. So they adjusted Zamorak's common drop table. In particular, players will be awarded more common loot and higher chances at rare drops for Zamorak when running the Elite Dungeon, and adjusted the weighting of rares on Zamorak's drop table, so players should see bow pieces slightly more often, and Chaos Roar codexes slightly less often when rolling for a rare. So how do we feel about this based on what we saw in our first 2 weeks here?
I am going to act on faith that the adjustments they've made will still have the Zamorak drop table being more profitable to just farm the boss.
Yeah.
And less profitable to take the time to run through the dungeon. But it punishes you less for running through the dungeon.
Yes.
That's my hope.
Yeah.
And they don't say in this tweet that you've got pulled up from Mod Sponge, where he effectively says, you know, we've changed the drop table, we're generally happy with where it's at, and we've made these changes, we've adjusted the amount of common drops that you get. It doesn't say if the common drops have gone up or down for low and rage in normal mode. And maybe it's more apparent for people that have really had a chance to get in and test it. I have not had this week. I've been a busy week for me.
Yeah.
But,
well, I can't test it because I'm still guarding that high score position.
Oh, that's true. You need a duo partner.
Yeah. Anyways, yeah. Let's go through this. Then I'll see where we're at with this. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I mean that's the like, my guess is probably that they made commons a little more common for low and rages to like pump up the benefit, because those low and rages are more commonly going to be done by people who do the dungeon, and it's going to be slower kills. Like, I think that's the idea, is that people who are at higher in rages or people who have the ability to get higher in rages can do faster kills, and maybe people at lower in rages are doing, as Shane is displaying, slower kills. For the record, he is certainly capable of doing faster than this, but due to some interesting lack of understanding of mechanics on release day, Shane is an absolute powerhouse of a tank, and decided half an hour was a good kill time for him for 0%.
The gap is now 5 minutes and 31 seconds between me and the next person.
And he's very proud of it. We're all very proud of him. It is kind of a cool...
It is. And I'm just going to sit there with this. But back to what Sponge said on this, and he specifically mentions the 99s, the 99% in rage, and says they're monitoring kill times and effort and input about these to see how that's going to settle after this. But here's the key point. Broadly speaking, we're happy with where things are sitting, and we're aware that higher in rages can feel less rewarding than players expect, especially when going dry on bow pieces. And that's the commentary that I heard in the community, is that people who were pushing in rage wanted the actual dungeon part, the undercity part, to be toned down in loot so that even these enrage pushes would still be more lucrative than that. So I think that's kind of what this is pointing people towards. But,
I mean, they are, right? Like, that's the thing, is that bossing and killing monsters are two very different jobs. And they talk about this in the RS Guy interview that we'll talk about later, but effectively, right, bossing is an exchange. You are saying, I am giving away time and money and supplies in order for a chance to roll on the drop table for this thing.
Yep.
And rolls on the drop table are incredibly valuable on average because of the rare drops, which are a dopamine hit. And again, we'll talk about kind of where those should fall. But, you know, the farming the dungeon part of it does not have that rare chance, right? Like, there's no dopamine hit there. You're exchanging gear for current still rolls on the drop table, but the drop table is consistent. It's smaller monsters. It should be more consistent, right? Like, that's, I believe, the design goal there. And so I'm pleased overall with them not making a whole lot of changes to how they're balancing the rewards for common drops, generally speaking. Yeah. And maybe that does mean that actually they should have lowered the common drops for the low enrages, right? It could have gone either way given the post. So.
Yeah, and he says, while we want to incentivize players for pushing enrage, we don't want to dissuade players from picking up their first kills or farming where they feel comfortable by making the boss only feel valuable for the very best PVMers.
Telos, don't give it the Telos treatment.
There you go.
Don't have $24.99 claims be oddly the best money in the game. Haha, jokes.
Yeah.
If you have a perfect tick, perfect rotation for several minutes at a time and can replicate that for the course of several hours, and suddenly you end up with billions of gold, well, haha, here we are.
And that's what, you're probably right, that's what this says. They don't want to have that same thing happening here. So.
Oh, I'm almost certain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okie dokes. Also, following feedback, changes have been made to the way group enrage works. Enrage is now shared between groups of 2 to 5 players, meaning your highest enrage will be applied to every group size. And this was initially, I think, due to a glitch that allowed you, so that if you went in with, say, 100%, you could have went in to a 200% if someone else in your group had 200%, I think. I think that's what this is getting at.
No, this was they were separated for score pushing because they wanted to have separate high scores for 1-man, 2-man, 3-man, 4-man, 5-man.
Okay.
Well, they did the race to 1,000%. They've realized since then that that does limit people's ability to kill the boss and do groups and enjoy the content at various levels. So they listened to the community feedback and have scaled back on wanting to keep those separate. That's what that patch is.
All right, fair.
Again, big appreciation for them listening to the community on that one.
Yeah, so important to do that in this day and age. When it comes to MMOs, and I think the most important thing any MMO company can do is to know their community. There was actually an interesting tweet that came across from the Melvor Idol developer, a talk he gave about knowing the community and whatnot, and that's interesting because that's published now by Jagex, but other MMOs, of course, have to deal with that, but we're going to move on at risk of going on a tangent here.
Our devs do a good job with it.
Yeah,
kudos. Well deserved.
Messaging has been updated at the end of Zamorak to clearly state the highest enrage you've achieved. Solo enrage is tracked separately and remains unchanged. And when you next log in, your enrages from groups 2 to 5 will be looked at by the system, and the highest amount will be taken. And a chatbox message will inform you of that. Okay, good. Doesn't affect me yet.
Not yet.
Continuing on, during Zamorak, if you are within Infernus, you'll now hear the voiceovers. So if you're in a solo encounter, you'll now hear the voiceover from the Decimate attack. And if you're in a group encounter, you'll hear all of the voiceovers while in Infernus. And I think that's really important for the attack in there that you need to Resonance Disruption Shield to avoid completely. Because previously
good,
it was just
good
based
QOL.
On looking at it. Yeah.
Good QOL.
They also reduced the number of Reaper kills. It was previously 1 to 8. Now it's 2 to 3.
You do 3 of those Reapers and then suddenly your Reapers become much faster.
Yeah. That's true. Very true.
But it's other elite dungeon boss tasks. So it's going to become a very fast task if you just have a
if you hit
to
the 25,
with,
yeah.
Yeah, or if you've cleared the dungeon 25 times, which I know a lot of people have just been farming it on normal mode, which is lovely.
Added quick chat options for kills and highest enrage. Also, when wearing the Vestment of Chaos armor set, the buff icon for the Berserk ability will now correctly last for 26 seconds rather than 20 seconds, even though the ability was lasting for 26, which signals to us that those are decoupled and done manually. That's interesting. And then comes the part we were wondering about. on launch week and the week after, and last week in particular, added the worst witch's grimoire requirement for the Master Quest Cape. That's the gathering all the lore pages from the dungeon.
Yep.
And finding and reading the archaeology journal, HFA, now awards the madness and malediction achievement. And that's part of the Master Quest Cape requirement as well. And that's from the archaeologist mini boss in there.
Yeah.
So good. I think that needed to be done. So.
Yeah.
And then we just got a couple of other little patch notes towards the end of it. Fixed an issue where a dynamo projectile shot backwards.
Sure.
Oops.
And have the drop chance of dino eggs from segregation and zygomite sporelings from care styling.
They were probably a little bit overpowered.
A little bit overpowered, yeah.
So that's fair.
And, I mean, people had 2 months, and it let them complete whatever breeding log they wanted to complete by this time. So
I mean, that doesn't help any future Iron Men at
That's
all.
True.
But
that's true.
It lessens the blow of the nerf that it was out for a while.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's it for patch notes. And interestingly enough, last Friday, the RS guy's first post or first video series that he's working on was published by Jagex about the economy, deaths, and inflation, and you could almost say taxes in that case, because they say the only thing
right.
present guaranteed in real life is death and taxes. So we're going to go through a bit of that. You guys have any early thoughts on that before we dive in?
I mean, I have a number of thoughts, but they're, I mean, on the content
okay.
throughout the thing. I have a number of thoughts, things to mention and discuss. I don't know how you want to go
all
about
right.
that. But
Tennis?
I'm just always interested in listening to these kinds of conversations because it's not something that affects me quite directly. But then it's one of those things where you can easily be swayed to different kind of opinions, because when you sit there and think about it, you're like, that kind of makes sense, or that kind of makes sense too. And so I'm interested to see, you know, where you guys are going to take this.
On the whole, I am personally happy with everything that they discussed. I think, again, I think that it's a good another good example of the devs being on the correct, what I personally believe is the correct kind of track in terms of spreading out and dealing with some of the issues that are currently being had in the game, the fact that they're looking at them and they're finding solutions that seem reasonable. There wasn't anything in there that was like a crazy, like, red flag, what are you doing? I think that's a terrible idea for game health or player engagement or whatever reason.
Yeah.
I think I'm pleased with what they put out there, and I think it was a good interview, generally speaking, for
okay.
content-wise.
Before we get to that, there was also, interestingly enough, a bit of a dev blog on this
yeah.
where they go over an infographic showing the result of Frank's free deaths that we had earlier this year.
Yeah. In March, I think?
Yeah.
February?
I think it was that. Or was that the one in December? I don't know.
No. This was, the free death week in December was a separate deal. Frank's free death was in this winter.
Okay.
Yeah.
Over 1 trillion... gold was saved. 6.5 million bosses defeated. By far the bosses that was killed the most was God Wars Dungeon Week, 3.1 million, followed
Ooh.
By Kings and Queens Week at 2.5.
I don't know that that's true. And I mean, okay, it is definitely true that the most bosses were defeated, the most boss drops were gained. But in terms of time spent killing bosses,
that's
when you
true.
Math out the average time it takes to kill Angel of Death, that is 7 people for several minutes, on average, typically, versus the time it takes for a God Wars dungeon instance. God Wars 1, you're killing those bosses in, like, for people that are farming them, probably 20 seconds,
yeah.
give or take
Sounds
5
about right.
And they respawn every 20 to 30 seconds, and or less if you're manually resetting your instance. Like,
so what we're saying is we should just completely ignore the second slide then.
Well, not ignore it. It's cool because it says that things are getting killed in massive numbers, but when you actually compare the time spent, you get a slightly... You show that there are slightly more solo PVMers and slightly more people who are willing to farm lower tier content, but the amount of time spent on average is not vastly different. The number of kills is vastly different, but the amount of time spent is probably not vastly different. Human logging to in time between
right.
these weeks.
All right.
And again, I didn't do all of that math, but just looking at it
yeah,
in terms of like...
It makes sense.
It takes, you know, 20 times as much human time to kill Angel of Death as it takes on an average efficient group as it takes to kill one of the other bosses, so...
1.1 million Dagonoth Kings, but once again, we know how quick those can be.
Shane, you and I farmed those for boss kill
hours.
Count at some point. Yes, indeed. Yeah. A couple of hours. It didn't take long.
No. Kriara, 583k. Next Angel of Death, 182k. Raksha, 144k.
Yeah. People did the thing that earned them money.
Yep.
Out of the options available in that week. No surprise.
Then we get to the deaths each week. 136,000 deaths, almost 137,000 during Dungeon and Raksha week. 65,000 during God Wars Dungeon week. 31,000 during Kings and Queens week. And 23,000 during Barrows and AOD week. Which
yeah.
I think is, once again, on par with the previous slides.
Yeah, and... Read to expectation in terms of Raksha and the Elite Dungeons have a lot of mechanics that are intended to one-shot you. The dungeon Elite Dungeons on normal mode are punishing for if you don't do the mechanics, you're in trouble, versus a lot of other things you can soul split through, like God Wars or other places. So, yeah, that matches for me.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So let's dive into what was talked about then on there. So. At the whole, death cost, they said, provides some access to money sinks. And what's going to happen overall is that death cost will be reduced at a high level, but not completely removed. And in some situations, they expect death cost to be 10% of what is currently being paid. With
right.
The cost based off
well,
of the GE.
No, they said some people can expect 10%.
Some people.
So
some
people are paying
yeah.
an average of 30 mil death costs. And they, when they said 10%, they said potentially you would pay low 3 mil. They kept using that 3 mil example throughout this. So I think they're massively decreasing it for people who are having a much larger number of unprotected items. And that everybody will feel a massive decrease. But I don't think everybody's getting a 90%
no,
decrease. I don't
would,
think
would,
we set
that
up as the expectation here.
I agree. And
okay.
we need to just be very clear in some situations. And you're right, they were talking about that 3 mil number a lot. So that's probably where it's going to land.
And again, I think that specifically that's addressing the folks who are bringing a lot of switches and paying, like on average, 30 mil death costs.
Right.
I think somebody who's, you know... in the more mid-tier level and paying currently 4 to 6 mil death costs, let's say, as an average number for somebody with endgame gear in one style and not terribly many switches, maybe a second DOF or something, I'm still expecting for those people to be paying a mil or two.
Yeah, and
right?
I think
like,
that's
like,
reasonable.
Right, no, absolutely. Right, like and they said this too, is that death costs are still, like I'll read a couple of these next ones, and death costs still based off GE value and taking in price scaling places, but the like some, and then they talked about the stuff we mentioned earlier where you're talking about the aspect of getting the same drop each time. And is that
right.
fun in terms of like if you split a 1 in 5,000 drop chance into 5,000 fragments and got one per kill, it's the same money per hour, but it's you don't get that dopamine hit.
Right.
And there's a fine balance in terms of making fragments of stuff versus making big dopamine drops. And they talked about that for a while and kind of just said there's a sweet spot in there and we're aiming to hit that sweet spot. And that's stuff that is being dropped in multiple pieces like the new bow and those kind of things.
Fractured staff.
Right.
Then on the other hand, the Armadyl battle staff from the Glaciers drops in 100 pieces.
Right. So they're putting it there and they're saying that they want you to still be putting in, like, there should still be some punishment for death, right? Like, they don't want people to
yeah.
just be willy-nilly, it's not perfect, and they just go, like, death cost should still carry some weight in that, you know, You could teleout in almost any of these situations now. So the impact of that they said, the flip side obviously is that that has an effect on inflation, where it is a big gold sink being pulled out of the game.
Yep.
As noted by when deaths are free and people are being much less careful about what they bring, I think it's prob you probably spend less than a trillion gold a month in the average month in gold costs, but
Oh,
if there
yeah.
weren't death costs, there would be, right? Like, I think the average month probably has half that many, if I
Yeah.
had to guess,
Yeah, that
right?
would make
If that.
sense. That would make sense.
Especially with Ring of Death and those kind of things. And so, pulling 500 billion gold out of the game every month is still huge, but, 1% of GE value trades, which is what
Which is the
they've,
next big thing.
yeah,
Every successful
probably accounts
GE
for that.
trade will be taxed at 1% applied to the gold given to the seller, so the seller will receive 1% less.
Yeah.
Tennis?
Well, maybe this will. I mean, it should crack down on merchant, but it won't. But
No.
Oh, just
it's a
wait.
good
Just
start.
wait.
I
It's a
mean,
start.
so again, this brings the issue of inflation and puts it, puts 80% of it or more of it, right, onto the shoulders of average players. And the question of kind of where is the gold coming from that's getting this
Bingo.
inflation, and it's alks, it's
Yep.
alkables. I think that's
Yeah.
you could make an argument that gold comes into the game through other means, but
It's the alkables. We know that. I know that.
raw gold comes into the game through alkables, but items come in through clues and through skilling and through all the other things. And so what this is saying is that people that are producing things that are worth value, not necessarily, right? Because you could make the argument that people who bring the gold into the game should bring the gold out, and that's how it was listed, is that PVMers supply the gold for the
Right.
game. What it really means is that PVMers supply the inflation. PVMers supplied the literal gold pieces,
Yeah.
but the value of items brought into the game is shared by everybody who uses those gold pieces and supplies things. The person farming rune ore in an old economy, or in a mica ore now, right, is still producing things for the economy, and so when they're earning that gold for themselves, like PVM just becomes the drop for gold pieces, as it kind
Yeah.
of always has,
Yeah.
and those gold pieces are used by everybody. And so the tax feels like, from my perspective, it is a more fair application in terms of people who have earned money will now earn 1% less, and that 1% will go to controlling the inflation in the game.
And the hope is
Now,
that it could take out more than death costs actually did with that.
right. I mean, the flip
And
side to that argument.
It's across the board, right? Like, so when a
Yeah.
PVMer gets a big drop, it's still 1% of their shit too,
Right.
right? When they
Yeah.
go to sell it.
Right. And even alkables, right? Like the alkables will be selling for less, interestingly. So PVMers will make money less money from alkables, and the people who are alking those alkables will, like, their margins will change slightly. Like, I expect alkables to just drop a 1% in price on average, which may not be
You
perceptible,
might
but
not even be able to see that.
no. Maybe on a systems level. I mean, and again, the issue with this is that, like, well, if we didn't have PVMers wanting to feel like they were being rewarded for things, then we wouldn't need to have those alkables and we wouldn't have the problem to begin with, so
And
their
that's what
problem is now
Modjak
ours.
said. If he wanted to
But.
fix inflation overnight, you'd just remove all the alkables from the game.
Yeah.
And he said that Stone Spirits was actually an experiment in this.
They'd also have to triple the drop rate on every boss rare because nobody would do bossing anymore and there would be none of them in the game because it would be incredibly
Yep.
unsatisfying
Yeah.
to, kill a boss and receive 5K
I mean,
input.
they have this going on in old school, and apparently it's working fine over there. So,
I think their tax is like 3% too. They
yeah.
also have a much, and I'm terrified to say this, it sounds and feels when I have played the game like they have a much worse merching problem than we do. And maybe
Oh,
that's just because the RS3 merchers hide it better.
yeah.
But like the there's a huge value of trades that are happening well above GE
Under the
value.
table.
And none of, well, even like on GE value, like max cash items
Yeah.
and things that are being traded in mass volumes and merchers that are, and I know we've got a few merchers that listen to this podcast who are,
We do?
not obviously doing. We've got people that that invest their money into buying things and prospecting the value to increase on them and then selling them back. Fair. Absolutely.
Fair.
And, like, this is nothing to say, like, we hate merchers. Merchers are the worst. It's the, like, that is you're valued to use your economics however you want to do so, and you are storing goods that the economy will then later want. That's entirely valid. I think the issue is kind of a lot of the price manipulation and people that are buying massive volumes of money specifically to manipulate the price.
Yeah, and
in
we'll
a way
get
that
there.
is not part of a free and fair market. That, like, those kind of people and the massive volumes of money that they're trading in, it will really feel a lot of this, and it will pull a lot of money out of the game from those merchers' pockets.
Yeah. And then they went into the Ring of Death with this, is that the Ring of Death will be reworked.
Right.
And that it should not feel like a crutch that players have to use. It won't have the same death-saving effect that it currently has now.
Well, right. Why do I want it? What the hell are you going to use it for? It's not been the best ring in slot for quite some time. So what would you use it for? They're going to make it DOA?
Oh, the Ring of Death?
Yeah. I don't know.
It's just going to be
my gosh. Interesting. I mean, no, people use the Ring of Death like mad, Dennis.
Are you talking
about
now?
But if they weren't saving their lives. I'm talking about after. Like, it's not going to have a purpose.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So they're repurposing it. They're giving it a new purpose. And they're saying it will not save your life anymore. They're giving it another function that they say will... Like, they don't want people to feel bad about having them, so, in theory, don't...
I mean, it's a Hydrix piece of jewelry.
Yeah. I mean, but, yeah, sure. But
I've listened to Thaxi long enough to know what the right rings are, and it ain't one of them. You ain't using it nowhere, so you can lie to your friends, I'll lie to mine, but...
I use it a lot of places.
I use it a lot of places, too.
Yeah, I use it for raids. Anytime I'm doing with groups I don't trust, a lot of, like, Elite Dungeon content where I'm... Where I don't mess
but
something
it's
up.
To save you. It's for its primary, like, it won't be
to save me money,
what it is
absolutely.
Going forward.
It will no longer be useful. But, like, I mean, I think the Death Touch bracelet should be used much less frequently than some people use it. Like, there's a couple of pieces of Hydrix jewelry that I look at and I'm like, you're a choice. Ingenuity of the Humans is, like, another one where it's, like, it's so niche. Like, yeah, it's a very in-game PVM, you ought to have it, but, like... Is it worth the Hydrix? No. It's not.
And that's going to be the key point, is making sure that it's seen as useful after it's done.
It's still worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. Mod Jack also described RuneScape inflation in a good way. He said the values of alkables goes down over time with inflation because alkables are flat. And alkables are the source of inflation. This means that earning potential and spending requirements will increase over time. Inflation doesn't work the same way as in real life, and a big problem with this is the GE price cap.
Right.
I never thought of it that way, but I can see that, in that if you have a stack of something like your Elder Rune in your bank, Tanis, that's going to go up over time with inflation, and it's not like you need to... it's not like real-life inflation where you're not able to, in effect, you know, buy food or whatever. Because you can still convert that to a higher amount of gold and buy whatever you need. And this is why I've been telling people, or at least I, once again, don't get your RuneScape economic advice from podcasters. I've been telling people that you probably shouldn't keep stacks of GP right now. I've been keeping stacks of items instead of stacks of GP for this very reason. But with this, the GE price cap is going up. Rather than 2 billion, it's going to be effectively 2 billion times 1 billion. So.
No, not 1 billion. I don't know where you pulled that from, Shane. In the notes and producer chat, too. They said a max tax. So 2.1 times 2.1 billion. Or effectively.
I'm fairly certain.
Is now 4.
I'm fairly certain that Jack said that he misspoke on that. I'm fairly certain that he misspoke on it, and it wasn't 2.1 times 2.1, it was 2.1 times a billion. But...
I mean, we can follow up on it later.
Yeah, we will. The point is that there is no item in the game right now that is going to run up against this.
Yeah. Well, like, let's be also, in the end, it actually truly does which one it is, and that shouldn't have even probably said, because at the end of the day, the difference is it's either 2.147 or 0.6 Q. That's not quadrillion, that's quintillion. That is 18 zeros. 18.
Yeah.
After that number. There's I would be surprised if there was that much value of items in the game. I just don't think there is.
No.
I don't think it is possible to have a max cash deck of a max deck, new max deck of anything, let alone gold.
That is a big number.
It's huge. So they've removed the limit job. I'm proud of them for working with the engine to get that done. It will be like the Sudibot issues, right? Other than being flamed and people being terrible people, a lot of the issues that they were having in terms of not being able to track that accurately, because there will always be a GE record of something being traded, right?
Which is
there's
good
no
on...
somebody like fakes a trade screen and doesn't accept it.
Yeah. And effectively what this amounts to is transparent platinum tokens, like the old school platinum tokens, except it's just handled internally by the game. That's effectively what this is.
Yeah. And none of the kind of annoyance of dealing with spirit shards.
Yeah. Money pouch will go up in value, but actual
because
coin
max
stacks,
stack of, yeah.
Max stacks of coins and items will stay the same at 2.1 bill. Rare but important gameplay items versus discontinued items will be handled slightly differently. And Mod Jack, I think, set the Party Hat community on fire because he said they were an important aspiration 12-plus years ago, but now they've just become a playground for merchers. And addressing discontinued rare items will have its own solution.
Like, how is that wrong? That's the only thing about this.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to mention, like, that's the only thing about this whole suite of changes that I would probably change. Like, when it comes to a party hat, when it comes to a rare, an item like that, instead of a 1% flat tax that is a regressive tax, I would probably rather it was a progressive tax that went up as, you know, the item becomes obscenely expensive. You should pay a higher tax.
I mean, blue party hats are, what, $300 billion right now? And you should pay 5-10% tax on that just to make it really obnoxious? Yeah, sure. I don't feel a problem with that.
And the thing is with this, even with the 1% tax, these aren't going to be traded on the GE. They're still going to be traded under the table.
Well, yeah. I mean,
individually,
I get that. But you could put... But
somebody could put one on the GE now if they wanted to.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you could do the same thing that they do with bonds, where, like, you want to trade it? All right.
10%.
You're paying the tax, man. Yeah, that's just how it works. Death of taxes, right, Shane?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And that could have been a much better title for their thing. Something about death and taxes.
That would have been a good
spoilers.
One, right?
Spoilers for the content, though.
Let's see. Apparently, before Timbo took over as lead balancer, the philosophy was to have items retain their value over time so that you could go away and you wouldn't necessarily be surprised with your bank dropping in value.
Godswords. Godswords should be some of the most expensive weapons in the game. We can't make anything that will devalue Godswords. Even when they released, like, Chaotix, those kind of things, they were really, really expensive and hard to upkeep, and so everybody still had to have a Godsword. Then EOC came and two hands became less valuable.
Yeah. And then I think the final interesting thing on this is there's an interesting design space regarding death costs and upkeep costs on certain items and then making them untradeable, like custom fitted trimmed masterwork. So the idea being is that if you're 100% certain you never wanted to trade an item again, maybe you could custom fit your Saren Godbow so that it would cost less to upkeep in some way.
Right.
But that's something that's just really far out there at this point, I think.
I mean, even like Hydrix jewels are all account bound. Once you equip it, you can no longer trade it, and there's no way to repair it to a tradable state, as far as I know, unless they've updated that, which
I don't
they may have done.
So.
But yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a handful of items that are like that. It's a choice. It's a design choice, and I am going to just trust their hands on it.
Yeah, and you know, I want to wait and see what the actual implementation of this looks like when it comes out. I don't know whether this is going to be August or September or October, based on the roadmap. I'm thinking September or October, potentially, based on what we saw. And yeah. Of course, we'll.
They said the Death Rework is coming out around then. I'm expecting it'll all be in a similar time.
In one.
Yeah.
And then I guess the only question to ask at the end of this is, will the high-tier PVMers and the people who want to, you know, learn, like we were talking about earlier, to enrage push at something like Telos or Glacier or Zamorak now, will they be happy with these changes? Will that allow them to do that without worrying about death too much?
I think so. And there's a couple things that go along with that. Like, one of them is, like, teaching people Virago. If you bring somebody that has lower experience at Virago, every time they take a hit, you get pushback, and so the boss fight becomes much more challenging with learners, and you're much more likely to die, so there's a pushback on taking them because of the death cost and the time sink.
Yep.
Time sink is still there, but if you want to teach somebody, you put in the time, and the cost is now lower. Same thing with people doing solo content, where the costs are now much lower if they only have their protected items. My expectation with this is that people who are not using as many switches will have potentially very low death costs.
That makes me happy.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it relieves the issue in large part.
And I was expecting to be upset at the whole GE tax thing, but based on where we're at in terms of prices and whatnot, it does seem reasonable.
The issue that I
you
do
saw
see
a flat tax
still.
And it warmed your heart, didn't you, Shane? You can admit it. I know.
No, I never actually thought of that now until you just mentioned it.
The thing that this does kind of sting for is Iron Man players.
Yes.
I know there's a lot of people that consider Iron Man to be endgame, and Iron Man still have to pay GE price for reclaiming their gear. Their economy is slightly different because they still get all of the alchemies from bossing. Bossing for Iron Man becomes more important in the standpoint of being able to earn gold, literal gold, but bossing will also be more challenging for them potentially because of where the GE will go, especially now there's no longer a GE cap.
Yeah.
Many items that currently have a GE cap are not are at the cap and will not be traded. If something can be worth four times the GE cap value, if that's not protected on death, that Iron Man will feel that in the way that it's the same item, and so that kind of sucks still.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it's a... And like they say, there's not a great way to decouple that from costs, because that is a good way to keep death costs appropriate with inflation.
I actually also just realized that we're going to need to do some changes to the way we track GE prices here, make sure that we're able to handle those bigger numbers. I don't think we are currently.
Yeah.
That's going to be an interesting episode. So, for anybody wondering who is watching video, you just saw my face when I realized that we have GE prices going back to the beginning of the GE, which culminates in millions of rows of data that needs to be effectively have its column size doubled, which is going to be an interesting endeavor.
Well, realistically, probably not increased by more than 3-digit places.
I'll explain it to you later if you want.
Okay.
Yeah.
Before we dive into the Liberation of Modcab stuff or that, I want to make two quick notes, things that we haven't talked about yet.
I know where we. Thank you for bringing this up.
One of them is the bow, and the other one is something else that was mentioned in the dev diary that we didn't talk about. Firstly, the bow. I said I did my math on the podcast 2 weeks ago talking about the average damage you would expect to get from the bow if you didn't formulate a rotation around. And it is, I'm still fairly confident, a 15-20% DPS increase at most, on average. That said, if you perfectly plan a rotation so that you know because you know in advance which hits of your bow are going to fire off the bow effect. If you were to tick perfect plan a full rotation and could keep up a fully tick-perfect rotation. Not ability, but actual tick-perfect, in addition to managing mechanics and other combat details, you could massively increase that number, because it is effectively 50% damage extra on your every fourth shot. You just make sure that every fourth shot is like a snipe, or a, you know, or a bow special, or something else that is really high damage. You can get mileage out of this bow, but it is not something you could do consistently without incredible levels of practice at each individual piece of content you wanted to do it on.
And we're talking like about it, being more tick perfect than four ticking at the divination area.
It is a designed speed kill trick, much more so than it is a like realistic combat expectation to do very well with this bow, right?
Yeah.
There are videos coming out from our speed killer community that are doing ridiculous. They're doing
the bow
like
is good.
Staff
the bow is
or
good.
Higher
the
levels
bow is
of
good.
Damage with the bow.
It
and
is
it's
good.
Great for that.
Yeah.
But for the average player and the average like PVM scenario, do not expect those numbers. It's really good and it's really cool and you can do a lot of fun stuff with it. But much like dealing with the complicated rotations for when arrows or for death spore arrows, those kind of things, it requires a ton of micromanagement.
And that's specifically
and
what it was. I went into the spreadsheet that I think it was the base tank provided, and it was a death spore when rotation, factoring in the high damaging attacks with the passive and the special of the bow.
Yeah, massive, massive, both APM and, like, your brain has to have a 0.6 metronome. You have to, like, there's a ton of practice that must go into that in order to do it right. And that's, again, dealing with boss mechanics and other things, too. So, like, encounters where you have any impact of randomness, being able to work with that, it's going to be very challenging to use the bow in that very optimized way. But it's real good if you can do that. And I didn't caveat that when I was talking about it.
Yeah, I think that's
other
important.
Thing to mention that they mentioned on the RS guys interview was that the Zami boss fight has bad luck mitigation. This is, as far as I'm aware, the first boss where the rare drops of the boss are in any way bad luck mitigated. And that worries me from a couple perspectives. One, just make the drops more common. What are you doing? I mean, that's my knee-jerk reaction to things.
Fair.
But from a like technical perspective, in terms of making groups, it is very common in RuneScape for people that like, if they want to receive more consistent money from a boss, like as if the boss had a larger number of fragments of something that were dropped, good design needs to be implemented.
Mm-hmm.
Right? People would do splits. It's that when we get a rare drop as a group, we're going to split it evenly among the group members. Now, the problem with that is that if Joey over here has gone 80 kills dry solo and then joined a group, or if Joey does 50 or 60 or 70 kills dry with a duo or a trio group and then joins a different duo or trio group and they then get a drop, does some of the value of that drop belong to his previous group if they're trying to split? Or like,
that's a good point.
The way that you deal with splits will not be equitable, and either that has to just be okay, or people have to no longer do splits, which, again, massively decreases the frequency of those, like, yeah, we got a drop. No, he got a drop. You happen to be here.
Yeah.
And so people may be less willing to do group content or less willing to do splits group content.
Yeah.
Which might suck.
But
hard to tell.
But it's going to depend on the magnitude of that bad luck mitigation, too.
We have no idea what this is or how long it takes to
or
build
where
up
it starts
what.
To kick in. Is it normal?
Which, again,
is it in rage?
Not knowing that doesn't make me feel any better about it.
Fair,
but
fair enough.
It is
and,
what it is.
And I mean, you know, give it 5 or 6 months. I'm sure they'll do a drop table post on Zamorak and it'll all become clear.
Or it'll all become very confusing if you've seen the Mazcap drop table post.
And we are going there next, but I got to thank Patreon supporters. Tanis, anything else on death, the economy, and taxes? RuneScape related,
no,
please.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. No, not really. I think we had a pretty good discussion on that.
Yeah. And I thought I was going to be upset about this, but I feel okay. So that's good. Alrighty. Of course, Patreon, you guys are always so wonderful to us. So big thank you this week goes out to Amos Reed, Andrew C., Arvidzel, Big Huge Rat, Bryflex, Chunk the Monk, Diana, Dominic F., Drama Free, Duramax, El Omady, Flaws of Man, Free Milk, Jade Gizmo, Jason S, Jeebus, Jesse W, Ling01, Lucky Ducky, Mohan V, Nate the Great, Nick G, OTR Gamer, Patty the Architect, Pernasius, Ricky A, Samuel FL, Skiotan, Seth W, Stubbeve, Tabby, The Naked Captain, Tom V, and Zant. Thank you, everybody. It truly means the world to us. You let us do all sorts of fun and crazy things. Last month, we had a wonderful monthly bit. We had one the previous month back about, or no, it was 2 months ago now, the Legacy Combat one. I love that one because we blew Tanis away with that. That's always funny when that happens.
You inspired me. I've been building my Legacy set ever since.
And
good work, David.
And there's a compilation of 48 plus monthly bits that you can now access for as little as $1 a month. All you got to do is head on over to patreon.com/rsbnb and sign up for our base plan. You get all that and a mention in our show notes. We do have a one tier up for $3 a month. You'll get a VIP rank on our Discord server, special chat channel access, and a mention on the podcast at the start of the month. And we also have our insider tier for $5 a month, where you'll gain access to the clips and the outtakes we used to make the clip show. We had a few of those from last week, in addition to everything else. And we do truly appreciate everything our Patreon community does for us. You guys are really special to us. And we love doing the podcast week to week, but there's just this little cherry on top of getting to go deep into something monthly bit related, or getting to just sit down with everybody like we're going to be doing this weekend at the round table. and then all the other little things that come up from time to time, like our inside updates, which we're probably going to bring back, my bank special, which is going to happen in August. Now we know that you can see the video version of Thaxi there, kind of shaking his head.
It's going to be an eventer.
I know Earth mentioned he was going to have a drink before that one. Are you going to need to do that too?
I might. It's not like, you're not the worst. Like, you're not a one-tab Andy. But, like, you've made some decisions, Shane. There are some decisions in this bang.
It is what it is. It is what it is. You'll be happy to know I discovered I have a preset for Clue Scrolls. I have...
Shane, okay.
I have... Just let me say what
four presets... We're going to be running so long on this episode. This man has been doing PVM for the large part of his RuneScape experience for, like, almost a solid year at this point. This man doesn't use presets, and he has a Clue preset?
I also have a mining preset. An archaeology preset and a farming preset.
The farming one makes sense. It irks me because every time we bank, he's very quick. It took me months to notice that this man actually just has to spend a couple minutes at the bank every time. He clearly knows where things are, which we're going to absolutely wreck when we have him redo his bank. It's going to be great. But like, oh boy, Shane. Resets.
That, in addition to the potential Hot One special at the $500 mark, and just all kinds of other little Patreon bits and bobs you gain access to, and you in effect, you get access to the back of the classroom kind of thing. So, patreon.com/rsbnb. Thanks so much, everybody, for allowing us to do this and indulge ourselves in what's going to wind up being another roast of me. So,
yes, sir.
Alrighty. Tanis, let's go back in time. Let's go back in time to July 2015. Earth was co-host of the podcast at the time. Mm-hmm. We got this thing that came out called Raids, the Liberation of Mazcab. We were told that this would be RuneScape's first raid.
And
it's largely the same as it is today. What was your opinion of raids when it came out back in the day? Did you interact with it at all that much?
A complete and utter disappointment. I really thought going into it... Well, I mean, I thought going into it, I was like, oh, this is going to be cool. I mean, this will be our first raids. Like, and I had been familiar with what a raid looks like from playing other things, and then when this came out, it was like, oh, this is a 10-person boss fight. That's, and then if you win, you get another boss fight. Cool. And you had to be so good. I never had it like directed at me, but I've seen people blow up in clan chats and just stupidness over raids. So, I've done them a few times.
Really?
But they weren't what I wanted. And what I wanted, we ended up getting with the Elite Dungeons.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think we can say pretty clearly in hindsight, Jagex agrees with you that they were not what they wanted. They were not clearly what the people wanted. I think that's not a controversial statement in hindsight.
Yeah. And just going back in time with this, the key headlines of it were that you'd be able to form it with the grouping system. You wouldn't necessarily all need to go there directly. You could be anywhere, join into the grouping system and get whisked directly into the boss. Level 90 tank armor, yeah. That was a first. Explore Mazcab, the Gobi homeworld, which we later did in the Call of the Ancestors quest in October of that year. And then this was the interesting skilling side of it. Help them transport goods between their two settlements in a warband safe. PvP D&D, perform tasks and battle the Aerith that roam the Gobi's homeworld.
Gobi bands!
Yeah, that never really took shape, did it, on the PvP side, I don't think.
No. I mean, you could kill people.
Yeah, but
there's not a whole lot of benefit to doing so.
No.
And the benefit of doing the activity is give or take, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah. So we're going to kind of dive into that. We're going to do our Then and Now series on this, and the way we're going to do it is we're going to cover it back the same way we did in 2015 on the episode that was with Earth, myself, and Mr. Bistro. We're going to talk about the bosses, then the rewards, and then the supply escort and the Nemi Forest. I hope Reed listens to this one. I said it the way he wanted me to say it. And then Mazcab reputation we'll cap it all off with. But suffice to say, going back on that, looking back at some of our commentary on this, we don't have any audio pulled from this one because it was just little bits and bobs, but Mr. Beaster said that it was a different boss fight and refreshing. And he gave us a very, very thorough overview of Beastmaster Durzag. Yakumaru kills were still very difficult at the time. No mechanics on it were covered except for Shark Pool, otherwise known as Sharknado. the ability, the poison mechanic, and the use of healing abilities, in his own words, were going to be very important going forward. And of course, the full content that utilized the grouping system. And we all know how we all love the grouping system, even in this day and age.
The grouping system has gotten a handful of quality of life changes and is still janky as all get out. Holy moly. The fact that your group has to be ready to start these fights, you have to be ready to start Beastmaster, but not Yakka. And if somebody leaves your group at a specific point when you're starting Beastmaster, you can glitch the fight still so that either Beastmaster never spawns after the Gobies, or that you can really mess up the like raids portions of raids with the grouping system still. And then the grouping system, of course, itself is just jank and kind of hard to get used to.
And the only other thing you absolutely kind of have to use it for in this day and age is Elite Dungeons, right?
And raids. You have to use
raids.
It's not optional.
Other. Other implies plus, but yeah.
Raids and what raids should have been, absolutely.
Yeah. let's go into the bosses then, eh?
Yeah. I mean, just to like say, I went back and listened to this section of the podcast.
Yeah, that's
from
what'd you think of that?
26. I mean, it's cool to listen to it because I was not a PVMer in any universe at that point. I had probably a dozen boss kills or so total, and I'd been playing the game for 8-10 years or whatever, but I was a skiller. I was working on max and questing and Master Questcape. Master Questcape was what got me into actually starting to realize that bossing was fun and accessible, hilariously, because I had to go and do a bunch of time in boss instances for it.
Right.
But that was 2016, 2017, right? I didn't start doing raids until the fall of 2017, which the fact that that was only 2 years after raids came out is astonishing to me, because I remember thinking when they came out, huh, that's not even vaguely my content. Interesting. Whatever, I'm never going to do those. Times change. But, like, even just hearing the descriptions of the way that he did things, where you're dragging the pets and the boss from one side of the room to the other, and you're dealing with the Irutes primarily, or the Chargers, and then the things that, like, it's yeah. very different.
And now, for Beastmaster, at the beginning at least, you kind of just go in, deal with the Irutes yeah. and Chargers.
So, setup-wise, the raids are set up very much, I mean, the idea is to mimic other games, where you've got a pull of adds and then a boss, and then another pull of, like, adds or monsters, additional damage dealers, adds, and then another boss. So in this, you kill a set of Irutes and Chargers, and then you kill Beastmaster, then you kill a set of Jellyfish, then you kill Kamaru. And the, like, so the way that, like, the pulls of non-bosses really feel like filler. They're not challenging. There's not, like, variety to them, and they're fairly quick, which is kind of the first thing where it fails to meet a lot of what is traditional MMO raid experiences, right?
Yeah.
But then, like, getting into the actual boss mechanics, right? So the way that we kill these bosses now, generally speaking, for Beastmaster and Yakamaru, Beastmaster, like, and we talk about this a little bit, too, in terms of what level of gear you need for this. Both bosses, I think, are doable with tier 80 power armor and weapons. Higher is recommended. I don't think a group of, even half, if half a group is learning, it's challenging to do the boss with tier 80 weapons. You need to have a very experienced other five to pull that off. There are, in traditional ways to kill these bosses right now, there are 5 roles for Beastmaster Jarzag that need to get filled, and there are 12 roles for Yakamaru that need to get filled. And many of them can overlap, and you can have multiple people doing roles, so you can have up to 4, occasionally in very coordinated groups, up to 5 free DPS, which is typically going to be your learners, right? But these bosses have incredibly high defensive values. This was right around the end of the phase when they were just giving massive defensive values
right.
and trying to say you don't have 100% accuracy on bosses. So your tier of your weapons really, really matters, because accuracy is very heavily driven by your main hand weapon. And not by armor or other things, which do drive your damage. And so having tier 80 or tier 70 weapons, I would say a very experienced group of full 10-man could probably pull this off with tier 60 or 70 gear, but it would take a very long time and would be very challenging. So, decidedly end-game content, right? In addition to the complicated mechanics and everything else going on. So, that is the first kind of gateway to get into things, is that having tier 90 weapons and tier 80, we're going to say power armor, is probably a base. That's what the Raid FC requires at a very base level.
And that becomes difficult for magic given the cost of the wands.
Right. And there's some caveats to that too, where wands could be better than a staff, but it's so hard to check if somebody, and consistently police if somebody has greater concentrated blast, and so there's a whole, that's become complicated.
Yeah.
Basically, have high tier gear if you want to do this content. And then kind of, if you want to get into and learning raids, the challenge right now with raids is that there is a reputation among a lot of the community where raids are full of rather toxic people. And the way that we'll explain that is that the people who are there are often, raids is almost entirely a solo experience currently. Very few people come in as a group where there's 2 or 3 people from the same friend group or things that are making a raid, unless they're kind of starting their own team. Anybody is welcome to start a team in the Raid FC, regardless of kill count. But you should know what you're doing in terms of leading kills. So it's not easy to start a team if you're 0 or less than 5 or 10 kill count. And then, you know, the bosses themselves are complicated. And people's expectations for a lot of these more experienced PBMers who do raids, because they only do the ones every 2 days, they tend to be solo, is that, like, you understand what you're going. And so there is a high expectation on execution for the bosses currently, which is challenging, because people will become unhappy. Like, anytime you're failing content, people will get, like, upset about it, and they will lash out at other people.
Yeah.
And the raid definitely experiences that as much as we try to curtail it. And so again, like, I would never go to a raid without having watched a guide first, or, you know, having a general sense of what's going to happen in the fight, but different communities deal with that in different ways, right? There's several Discord groups that will go, a number of PVM communities will go on their own, and then you've got, like, the PVMing FC, Raid FC, you know, Boss School. There's a handful of raiding communities that will do specifically learner events or teams that are more learner-friendly. Versus places like the Raid FC where, and I love the Raid FC, right? I help run the place. But the Raid FC caters to people who want fast, efficient kills, right? Failing a kill in Raid FC is not looked upon fondly. And it's been happening much less recently than it did when I started raiding, but, you know, there are certain things that you can do that will.
Because you're
your
left
group.
With an experience after that. Oh shoot! I just wasted 25 to 30 minutes of time trying to get this team together. We got Beastmaster done, but Yakka
was challenging.
Yeah.
Well, and you can go back to Yakka afterwards, right? Like, so once you get the Beastmaster clear, you can still just refight Yakka. That is a change that's been made. But like, I taught Shane almost entirely in Raid FC groups. But if you're going to do that, my recommendation is find somebody who can be on voice with you to really help and talk you through kind of what is happening in the kills. The nice thing about learning raids is that even if you die, you do still get loot if your team gets the kill. Even if only two people survive, right? If you got a couple of heroes finishing off that Yakamaru Mirage, you still get loot. And like that as a situation. Oh, very rarely. Shane doesn't die a lot.
No. I mean, I've been there as one of the few people left.
Oh, true. Yeah, absolutely.
I haven't told you some of the more recent stories.
Oh, I can only imagine, but that's definitely a conversation for later.
Yeah.
But anyway, so, yeah, that's kind of all the commentary I have on kind of getting into raids is that you should those. The thing that I will plug, personal plug, every 2 weeks, Raid FC has a learner event where we significantly lower our requirements for gear, and we'll teach anybody who is willing to come and show up. It's outside the World 71 in Mazcab, outside of the raid's entrance. I will say, if you come, we usually only run one or two teams, usually two if we can pull people together, sometimes three if we know it's going to be a busy week. And each team takes four people per run, so it can be a while. Sometimes we take a wait list and we'll message people in-game. It's when, you know, we need people when it's time for them to come for their team kills. Otherwise, bringing fletching supplies, there's a bonfire there. You can do fire making outside of the thing. It's just something I would recommend. Or just coming and chilling and having a show on in the background and just keeping the game up. Because those teaching events can take a while just based on the limitation for kill size. But that's every 2 weeks, Saturday afternoons. You can see that it's actually on the in-game calendar. And we'll take everybody regardless of kill count and everything. Yeah, we're on the in-game event calendar again. So if you're looking for those, you can find them. I'm one of the people that will do teaching for those anytime I'm free for those Saturday afternoons. And the groups that get together for that are all volunteer teachers who are more than happy to be there. It's a lot of staff, and they'll absolutely get you those kills and very actually teach you the mechanics of the boss and let you see them. And we'll walk you through all of it at the time. So there's my plug. But I'm traveling this week, so you won't hear my dulcet tones. But there will be, I am familiar with a couple of people that are going to be doing calls and teaching for this week. You've got a good crew. So keep an eye on the in-game calendar. It's there. Once you've got a good, like, 10 or more kills under your belt, finding kills through the Raid FC is usually something you can do within a half an hour, especially if you raid around the reset time, because a lot of people do raid at those hours, and a lot of teams come through. Yeah, Saturday the 23rd at 1800 is the next teaching event. So anyways, that's my, like, hey, if you want to get into raids, please do it. They're a ton of fun. We heard, you know, if you go back and listen to the podcast, you'll hear kind of a description of how they did mechanics back then. As a quick overview for the raids fights, for people that are not familiar with, Beastmaster Dirzag, there's about 3 million health total between the pets and Beastmaster once Beastmaster spawns. Typical kill time is about 2 to 3 minutes for organized groups. And in terms of important mechanics, there are a lot of, like, additional damage dealers that either need to be killed or just healed through. Beastmaster can be very easily done with almost no food by the typical damage dealers, but is rather punishing on the tanks. I think Beastmaster, personal opinion, is the most challenging boss to tank in this game because he has an enrage mechanic. Every fifth auto attack he hits you once he's... at any point, will reset your defensives. All of your defenses, it will put them on a 5 to 10 second cooldown, meaning that any defensive you have active will deactivate. So Beastmaster's tank needs to be very careful to manage their defensive uptime. Each one of those stacks also increases the damage that you take from the boss, and the stacks can be removed by half if you use the freedom ability. So you have to be very careful. A lot of people will time their freedoms at specific stat counts to keep themselves from getting their abilities reset. But you have to balance that in terms of the amount of damage that you have coming in. So very challenging to tank does typically, unless you have massive melee damage negation, which is possible now, very difficult to solo tank. So you'll have an off tank who will take the boss so that you can remove, the main tank can remove their stacks before taking the boss back. Otherwise, the infamous pig bombs still exist. They've been changed so that they deal magic damage now, which is mitigated by prayers. So you can prayer swap in and off of them, or you can click them to disarm them.
What,
like
they used to be typeless?
They used to be typeless 2000, yep. Now it's soft magic damage.
Okay.
So devotion will completely block them, but the bombs also reset defensives. So devotion will not work, but the devoted perk will. There's a handful of things about those, ways to deal with them that have changed over time. Otherwise, Beastmaster very much just a apply damage to the boss kind of a thing. The enrage, where the boss starts hitting in a large area around him and really applying those stacks heavily to the tank, happens when either the boss hits half health or when his first pet dies. He spawns with two pets. So the goal is usually to kill the two pets and get Beastmaster to 7 to half life points at the exact same time. That's kind of the big, like, coordination check for the fight.
Right.
Otherwise, mechanically, just do damage to the things, keep yourself alive, you're doing okay. Terrible for Beastmaster.
And from that, it sounds like, and looking at it this way, because it feels like, even just looking at these mechanics in 2022 for Beastmaster, it's an interesting fight, at least from the tank's perspective, assuming the rest of your team mm-hmm. is doing what they want to do, or doing what
damage.
They have to do right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's been my consistent thing that kept me coming back to raids, is that it's dynamic in that sense based on
everybody has a job.
Everybody has a unique job. Yeah.
And you can learning all those different jobs is challenging.
Yeah.
Which brings us to Yakamaru. Yakamaru, again, like I say, there are 12 assigned roles that are typically used in the Yakamaru fight. Each of those people with those roles has a specific job to do. You can, in some instances, take two or even three of the basic roles that don't overlap with each other, but you must have at least 4 to 5 people who are coordinated doing those roles. You cannot have more than that of free DPS. And what I'm going to say for Yakamaru in terms of mechanics is that, again, in my opinion, Yakamaru is the most complicated boss in the game in terms of things that can be going on at once. Most bosses in the game have a large number of mechanics, right? Solak, Virago, a number of bosses can rival Yaka in terms of the number of mechanics that they have and that you have to know how to deal with. The difference with Yakamaru is that Yakamaru can have multiple of those mechanics happening at once. And a lot of them will interact in funny ways. Some of them will require you to move or stand next to people, while others will prevent you from moving. Some of them will require bosses to be hit with specific abilities, but if they're hit multiple times with those abilities, they'll do massive reflection damage back onto the group.
Yep.
So, and there's, like, a number of ways to deal with a number of the mechanics in terms of the Sharknado mechanic. When it first came out, people thought that they needed to, like, physically fish all of the sharks out of this tornado before it exploded. Now we completely ignore it and just run away and then come back once they've gone. All right, so there's things like that are done in specific ways. And the tail end of the... So the way the boss is set up, there's 3 mechanics during the actual boss fight in terms of basic information. Let's start there.
All right.
5.6 mil HP for the boss plus the side pools in total plus any health that is added through the jellyfish adds that spawn. Typical kill time for organized groups, 5 to 7 minutes. World records down to like 3. You know, long kills up to 12, potentially. That's kind of your range. So very, very wide range in terms of the number of people that are alive and how your group is doing. 3 basic mechanics present throughout the fight at all times. The boss can spawn a jellyfish add, which does AoE melee damage around it. The boss can turn somebody blue. They have to stand next to somebody to pass that blue to somebody else. Otherwise, they take increasing damage. And the boss has stacks. The stacks apply onto the tank and anybody standing near the tank, and increase the damage taken by that person up by 20% for each stack. Every auto attack applies a stack, and the maximum is 15. So the tank traditionally will be taking 2 to 4 times the damage of the rest of the group, and thus the need for a tank and somebody who's mitigating that damage. There is a central pool that has all those mechanics, and then there are 4 side pools. 4 side pools each have an individual mechanic on their own. One pool needs to be stunned. One pool will sink you into the ground except for 20% of your group rounded up, who must free the other people. One of the pools will fire out the big shark NATO. Another pool has a tendril mechanic, which is largely the responsibility of the tank. When each of the side pools has 1 million health, when they reach 10% health, they release a poison, which looks... Somebody has to stand on the point where it's going to land. They have to move to that location, which is almost always within 2 to 3 tiles of a player in the group, but there's a specific person assigned to grab it. One person per pool... Anybody who's standing on that spot will catch the poison. That person must then stand next to the pool when the pool dies. Otherwise, the fight doesn't progress and you reset the pool you're currently on.
And that's when things can get kind of annoying if that happens multiple times.
If multiple people catch the... So effectively, if somebody misses poison, doesn't catch it, or if the person doesn't get into melee distance in time, you add 1 million health to the fight. If multiple people catch the poison, it does very significant damage and will likely burn through most of that person's food stores before they're able to clear that poison. It is a problem and is something that needs to be coordinated around.
Yep.
Once you've done all 4 side pools, Yakumaru will then enter a mirage phase where all 4 pools are active at the exact same time. Each of them has every single one of their previous mechanics. So you get multiple blues, you get multiple things, you get pools sinking people into the ground, pools that need to be stunned. You have a lot of... It's a little bit of chaos. The bright side, each pool has 1/7 the HP it has previously. It's only got 150k. So you burn them down, you close the pools, and that's the end of your kill. And that mirage phase in particular is the, like, chaos. Coordination is key. Everything has to be done in a specific order to have a nice, relatively clean kill.
I think I killed a north tank or a base tank once in mirage by accident.
You did. You absolutely sunk a north tank into the ground, and I think you may have messed up gotten a base tank tendriled, and there were a couple of adventures during Mirage, but you got it. You picked it up pretty quickly. It didn't hurt that you record so much of your online experience, and we could go back and just review the VODs and say, "Hey, you did this thing here. Don't do that again."
Yeah, and we go back to that first kill.
Yeah,
that was an adventure.
I mean, Shane's first kill, he spent an awful lot of time standing around not targeting things. For the record, kill the jellies, then the side pools, then the middle pool, pretty much always. But regardless, so there's your general overview of the fight. There's a lot going on.
But hey, that was in December, and now I'm pretty much able to do all proficient. But 2 rolls there. So
there we go. We need to get you learning base. I need to come in and help you with that.
That and poison tank.
Splated dive. So, rating in 2022. The difference is mechanically, right? The advancements of things like bladed dive to get a singular person onto that poison spot, no matter where it spawns. Really helpful. The buff bar. Before the buff bar existed, you got a notification when you hit 5, 11, and 15 stacks in your chat box. Otherwise, you had no way to track how many stacks and damage you're taking. Well, especially for Beastmaster, where he resets your defensives, right? And you need to, like, actually be counting his auto-attacks on you before. Buff bar was huge for making tanking for this way more doable. That's one of the things they were talking about, was changing aggro and healing. When Mr. Beastro was talking about it, it was because the stack mechanic existed and people didn't know what to do with it. There's just been a ton of interaction bug fixes in terms of preventing issues that were stopping kills from being completable. And preventing other issues that have been had in the lost. There's still a few funky interaction things, like if you're doing the rapid fire ability when the Sharknado explodes, you get stunned as if the monster had died.
Yeah, but that happens in other bosses too, right?
Boofs, anyways. I don't know if that happens elsewhere where the boss is still alive and able to attack you. I don't know that there's a whole lot of other places where the boots will stun you in combat like that.
Is there anything you want to mention about puzzle? Because we didn't mention puzzle.
We did mention, I mean, I mentioned at the start that there's a jellyfish section that you need to kill. Yeah, again, there's some, like, little raid bits and bobs that are, like, they tried to put raid-like elements into it, and really, it is just a pair of bosses that require 10 people. And the person requirement is simultaneously, obviously, coordination requirement, and also, like, because it is so many solo people, because you can only collect loot from these bosses every 2 days, it just, they have not been a very popular overall in terms of number of kills per day, right?
Yeah, that's really disappointing to me.
The number of bosses get killed per day is probably in the hundreds, if that.
And that's disappointing to me now that I appreciate the content.
Yeah. Because it, I mean, it's complicated, it's challenging, but it's very achievable, and, you know, you can do it consistently. And again, I feel very good about killing the bosses. I enjoy them.
But yeah. And I want to say...
There's a reason.
Go ahead.
There's a reason we never got our third raid boss, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, they effectively told us there's supposed to be a shaman. The shaman is in the Gobi prison, so you wash from the prison yard, effectively, through a pipe system to around the corner from where the prison is located in the water behind the Mazcab area. And then you would wash through a cave or back through a whirlpool in the Yakamaru fight over towards the prison. And the prison's actually visible. The outside of it is visible from the Beastmaster Arena out back. So you can see what the outside of the arena should have looked like for the third boss fight. And it just wasn't popular enough for them to have put the time into designing the shaman who was supposed to be the prison warden there. Yeah, which is a bummer. But
yeah, and
understandable from a design perspective.
And one of the interesting things for me is that I'm 75 kills in and I'm still learning things to this day that are go on different or ways to optimize going forward with all the different roles too. So that's why it has been rewarding to me on that front. And
I mean, there are
I wish more people
little
could
see mechanical
that.
Things.
Yeah,
there are little mechanical things that like I was still learning picking up. There was something I learned at like 450 kill count that blew me away. Like, I think if it's more than 8 squares away from the sand pool on Mirage, you can't be sanded. And so there's like you can mark kind of out where those tiles are to know that like you're safe if you know a sand is coming because the rotations happen in consistent order. You can like you can step away and then you've got an extra person to free people during the Mirage phase. Doesn't work during non-Mirage. But again, like little odds and ends like that because there's so many interesting interactions of like what happens if you're blue and get sanded or if you have the blue and you have the poison and you get eaten and then it gets brought to the beach and like there's a lot of like nuance to it that I find very engaging.
But, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Tanis, any questions about mechanics or anything to that effect?
No, Yakimaru still sounds over? You know, just as bad as it did when I tried it early on. So haven't convinced me on this one.
It becomes a mess pretty quickly if you're not coordinated about it, unfortunately. I mean, yeah, so that's most of what there is for the fight. Let's move on to talk about some rewards for a bit, right? The big raid rewards, I mean, on release, were a new set of ability codexes and tier 90 tank armor. Specifically, two versions of tier 90 tank armor. One buyable with currency that is a consistent drop from the raids. Again, great drop design, personal opinion. And one that is dropped actually from the bosses. Let's spend a minute on drop mechanics for this, because
I think these are
very well done. Between the tank armor and the codex, getting a drop from a raid, assuming you have max reputation so you have a reroll available, is like a 1 in 5 to 1 in 7. It is really common to get raid drops. Which is nice because you can only get loot once every 2 days. So, you know, that does in some ways balance itself out. But it's relatively consistent rewards. If you don't roll a unique, you will always roll the techie currency. which can be used in the reward shop to buy the ability codexes in a tradable form, which the drops are also tradable. You can buy them for non-tradable, so you can always sell the drops that you get. Or you can buy base versions of the Tier 90 tank armor. And we'll start with the Tier 90 tank armor, because it was obviously the first Tier 90 tank armor.
And prior to Krosis, the only Tier 90 tank armor that was there for Magic, right?
It is, and the only Tier 90 tank armor available for range, too. Actually, also Magic? Because Elder Rune. Elder Rune technically was Tier 85?
Yeah, 85.
Okay, so yeah, only Tier 90 for any style before other than Deathspore. Wow, Deathspore. Yeah, Krosis. The Krosis armor. Why am I? I've blocked it from my brain. Kriploom.
There you go. Yeah,
get out. Don't want. Bad. I have so many issues with Kriploom that we can talk about later. Just, you're wearing tank armor. I don't care that you're still doing as much damage as somebody else because Staff Gilbert. You're still wearing tank armor. You can do better. Why are you sandbagging my team? Get out. Anyways, now that we have my lovely opinion on tank armor, let's talk about tank armor that these drop. The tank armors from raids come with a unique passive, and the buyable version and non-buyable version have two differences. So the buyable version, they have the same armor value, should be noted. The buyable version has, I believe, tier 85 health scaling on it. So the buyable version only gives you the equivalent, it's I think 450 less health than the Octo dropped version. And the Octo additionally has a secondary passive that increases, that gives you damage equivalent to an offhand. It gives you when you're wearing a shield. So it gives you 10% of your shield's tier. So if you have a tier 90 shield, each piece of Octo armor you wear gives you 10% of that shield's value as a level. So wearing one piece of Octo gives you the equivalent of a tier 9 offhand. Wearing five pieces of Octo gives you the equivalent of a tier 45 offhand. It should be noted that, like, if you're wearing a Defender, you could get the equivalent of, like, a tier 75 offhand. Which is like, yeah, you lose relatively little damage by wearing, as opposed to two tier 90 main hand offhand, by having five piece Octo with a tier 90 main hand and a Defender. With that said, you're still wearing tank armor. So you still lose all of the DPS from your armor stats. You lose the passives off of Cinderbanes, off of Dino Boots, off of ability altering gloves. Even off of other tank gloves like the Dominion Tower gloves. You're losing a lot of passive abilities by wearing this particular set of tank armor. So the damage doesn't compensate, but it's a nice buff for places like Telos or other places where you need to wear tank armor. Having the Octo, the full tier 90 health bonus off of Octo, plus this extra little damage is nice. It's also worth noting that both versions of the raid armor have a unique passive. That passive is that every piece of the armor that you wear gives an increasing chance that every time you take a damage hit splat, all of your defensive abilities get reset. There's a 1 second or a 1 minute cooldown on when this activates. Basically, if you have any defensives on cooldown, once a minute, you get those defensives back. This is a large part of the reason why the turtling perk is so strong for tanking, because when wearing these armors with the turtling perk, which extends both the duration and the cooldown of the barricade ability, you don't have to worry about that extended duration of the cooldown, because the cooldown will be most likely reset before it's back up again. So it requires a more dynamic tank rotation because your tanking abilities are up much more often.
Yeah.
And that's still the primary driver for wearing these armors, is that those defensive resets are so valuable. Even getting an extra, like, resonance reset, if you're in a tough spot for healing, getting an extra devotion, right? Having your devotion on less than a minute cooldown? Like, if you're killing stuff, you could have crazy devotion uptime.
That's massive.
Yeah, it's huge. Especially if you can get the thing synced up, right, so that your reset is coming in when you've just started the cooldown for it, right? So it's not incredibly consistent. I think the maximum is like 5 to 7% or whatever, right? It's on the tooltip in-game. Thank you for the mods for putting those tooltips in so we see the percent to get the reset. But that's the true value of this armor.
And my question is, where would you use this?
So the deal with this is that these armors are useful anywhere that you need to wear. Well, duh, anywhere you need to wear tank armor.
Well, obviously.
But like, you're wearing tank armor for like learning base tanking for a lot of places. Almost every situation, you're better off wearing power armor because the damage, the like 15 to 20% damage roll from power armor is just massive. It just is.
Mm-hmm.
And is valuable.
You can
and the
feel
passives
it
you get
if
from
you haven't
other
worn power armor before.
Right. Also worth noting that the buyable versions of the armor are not augmentable. So the buyable version's really not great if you want to wear them. Like, if you wanted to wear your ability-altering gloves or cinderbands and your dino boots with armor, and you still want to have, like, a three-piece armor bonus from Cliproom or things, or from this, you, like, you need to wear helm, body, legs. And so having augmentable is actually fairly important.
And that only comes from raids.
From the Octo Raids armor,
yeah. Octo Raids armor.
So, like, if you were in a situation where you wanted to do some nice AFK, like, farming with, like, Animate Dead, you're much better off with Octo, because then you're in your tank armor, you could wear your Octo with a Defender or something and just have truly massive damage mitigation, right? You get much less punished for wearing a Defender if you have Octo on versus if you don't. Those kind of things are where you would still use this.
All right.
It's niche, and if you can get away with power armor is still almost always better. But if you're going to be wearing tank armor, it's a good choice. Also, I think they just look really cool.
Yeah,
there's
they
not
do.
A lot of armors in the game that look like these, and the Octo versions in particular, like the Octo melee chest plate,
they just
the
got
ranged
a nice,
helmet.
A nice kind of trimming to them.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the range, the shoulders glow nice. Like, again, there's it's... I like the effects on them. I think they're pretty armors.
Let's move on to abilities or anything else on the armor?
Nope.
Okay.
They're cool. I like them.
And in the interest of time, we'll just say that when Corruption Blast and Corruption Shot were first announced, we were very pleased with them then. They still form the basis of pretty much every ranged and magic rotation.
They've been bumped off their throne, but for 5-6 years, they were the strongest available basic ability for magic and ranged. And they've been dethroned slightly by G-Conk and by Gricko and a few other things, but of the base abilities you have access to for stuff that's only 40 mil and not crazy expensive like Gricko, they're very, very powerful and still very pleased with that. Storm Shards and Shatter.
Mr. Beaster was very happy with these on release.
Yeah, and I would say currently they're probably the least useful of the abilities. There are certain places where you need them, and that's very much an endgame type of a scenario, right? Storm Shards and Shatter, the way that they work, you stack Storm Shards, so the Storm Shards have a cooldown, but they build up on your target, and they persist on many bosses that transition between phases. For example, Raksha, Virago, similar. They don't work on Yaka, I don't believe. Out of bosses that have very large health pools where you need burst damage, the Shatter ability consumes all stacks of Storm Shards to do incredibly massive damage hits. So in places where you needed burst and you have a while to do setup, or a large number of people who can all apply Storm Shards because Storm Shards are tracked globally. So if 5 different people apply Storm Shards, the boss has 5 shards on it. And then only one person needs to shatter. The actual damage you get from the ability solo and for like individual content, fairly low. Like, these are niche use when you need that burst. But situations like Telos, Virago, a number of other places, they're great in terms of putting out damage on a like delayed basis to say, I'm going to save some damage, do less damage now to do more damage later. That's what those have become.
Onslaught is the interesting one.
Yeah, Onslaught's the last ability here. Onslaught is similarly niche, right? Where you need to do massive burst damage or where you need to finish off a target or similar, right? We've gotten additional sources of burst, looking at you, Fractured Staff, since this came out, where Onslaught is no longer your best potential option for burst damage. But for the longest time, the way that Onslaught works is it does progressive hits, and each hit does increasing damage to an almost ridiculous degree, but each hit takes 25% of your adrenaline. When you run out of adrenaline, you start taking, I think it's a quarter or 10% or something of the value of the damage you deal as self-damage, mm-hmm. as reflection back onto you. And then when you get to hits above 10, like the 11th hit, 12th hit, etc., each hit additionally adds 1,000 extra reflection damage back to you. So if you manage to survive 12 hits, that 12th hit will hit you for a quarter of the damage dealt, which is massive at that point because you're doing so much damage, as well as 2,000 additional damage. So it becomes, like, it will kill you, and the ability does have the ability to kill you if you just channel it.
Oh, yeah.
But it can do 50, 60,000 damage within a short time frame, very short time frame, and can be a good way to burst through things like Nex's blood phase for people that are learning Nex, for places like the stun pool on Yakamaru for those with that Ceridomen Godbow spec, or Saren Godbow spec, wow. Ceridomen Godbow spec does something very different. So, again, use of Onslaught, niche, burst damage, third phase on Talos, Red Beam, great use of it as well. But not something you use in, like, Slayer, your typical PVMing.
All right. I think that covers the rewards. And the goal with all these is to always provide a more in-depth overview of the content and look at where it's at today versus where it was when it came out in 2015 and what we were able to cover it with. And I think we did that. We also just mentioned the Supply Escort and the Nemi Forest are exactly the same as they were. Mazgab Reputation does cap out at 5,000. I don't know why I wrote 3,500 in the notes, but it's definitely 5,000. Gives you some things like extra banks and such.
Mazgab as an environment is cool because it is something we don't have elsewhere in RuneScape. And I would not be mad to see them using spaces like Tardiad and elsewhere.
Oh, yeah.
To build out the RuneScape kind of universe more and to get a wider range of environments. But, yeah. Overall, good job. It's been largely forgotten.
Tanis, any questions, anything to add before we move on to what we've been up to?
No, I mean, I think we covered this pretty well. I think it was covered pretty well back in 2015.
Oh,
and
I don't think
the
so.
Most, I think so. I just think it's neat now to hear the differences in the way that the mechanics are handled and how it's being, you know, handled now. It's not quite enough to probably make me jump in a Raids FC and try to do something, but it sounds like it's better, so that's a good thing.
And I'll just end with this quote from Mr. Bistro from that episode. He said, "You just have to put yourself in that situation and you'll be comfortable. You can do it, Shane."
He was right.
Yep.
Prophetic.
It took me about an extra 6 years on top of that, but I got there in the end.
That's all that matters.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, with that being said, what have we been up to? Or sorry, not what have we been up to. Picks of the week. Sorry, that comes first. Taxi, you go first for pick of the week.
Yeah, my pick of the week is something I think a lot of people may have heard of if it's something you're interested in, but just the Stormlight Archive by Brandon Sanderson. It's a series of very long, very much high fantasy books. Set in a kind of a universe that has its own form of magic, very much swords and sorcery, standard high fantasy. And if you're interested in fantasy reading, I would say it's designed to be adult fantasy in terms of, like, it's swords and sorcery, but there's a lot of, like, there is slavery in this world and it is a hard life, and the stories that are being told are fairly complex. But if you're into fantasy reading and it's not something you've seen before, I'd highly recommend it. There are 5 or 6 books in, so it is something that will keep you occupied for quite a while.
And the first one is 1,250 paperback pages.
Yep, absolutely. They're chonkers.
So there you go.
Link
will be in the show notes at update.show. My pick of the week is the Lightning Map, which for those of us in summer in the northern hemisphere currently, we occasionally have bad weather roll in, and you often wonder exactly where the lightning is going to be and where the storm is. And you can track that, of course, with radar. But what's interesting about this map is that it actually shows what's actually happening lightning-wise. Here we can see that there's a lightning storm going through southwestern Ontario and one just currently west of Akron, Ohio, currently as well, that I just zoomed into on this. And this is fairly accurate and very real time. So if you're ever interested in seeing what's happening, aside from just the regular radar maps and where the lightning is coming in your neck of the woods, if it's not looking too great outside, well, lightningmaps.org will tell you that. But of course, we'll just take this opportunity to remind everybody that if you are in the middle of a lightning storm, be careful. Be careful. Be inside or be somewhere else safe. So that's my pick of the week week. Nice. Yeah, and it loads into wherever you are. I'm wondering what's happening in Ohio currently. That's a pretty big one. But all right,
storms.
Moving on to achievements, Tanis, you want to start us off?
Yeah, let's get started here with Barazzi with 99 divination on July 19th, and then Skips with 99 fishing and farming on the 19th. And then Dane Carre with 99 Dungeoneering on the 18th.
Nicely done.
Also on the 18th, we had Lord Dusty with 120 Magic and Exploited One with 99 Dungeoneering. On the 17th, we had Irindil 20 with 120 Dungeoneering and Mr. M with 99 Construction. Good jobs.
Then continuing on the 17th, we have Silly Cat 98 with 120 Farming. On the 14th, we have Azadia with 99 Runecrafting and 99 Divination, or sorry, Dungeoneering. Then we also have Godin with 120 Farming, Jamandy52 with 120 Strength, and Skips with 99 Firemaking. Well done, everyone.
Woo!
Nice.
Alrighty, Tanis, it's been a while since we heard from you. What have you been up to?
Well, hurting. But one thing I can say is when I was sick, I took full advantage of RuneScape's mobile options and just set and did my smithing. I'm close to I'm getting back up there. I think I'm back up to about 200 mil. So I'm still about 400 mil shy for my crit bloom pants, Daxi. Sorry, I call them my survival outfit. That's my survival
that's
gear.
That's odd. I mean, hey, if you want to run that in solo content, go for it.
Absolutely. Power to you. Yeah, all the more power to you.
And we'll go to the Elite Dungeon when you get it, right? Or before?
Oh, yes. Yeah, okay. For sure.
Okay.
So that's kind of what I've been doing. I have made a couple little side diversions and done some arrow making, just because I still think that's kind of good. But for the most part, yep, lots of smithing.
All right, Thaxi, what have you been up to?
Oh, I mean, the usual for me. Some raids. I'm still been playing a ton of ESO, so I log into raid and to say hello and. You know, just check in with stuff, occasionally do some dailies, but I've been keeping it low-key. I got invited to a couple of Zemi instances this week and have been busy or asleep for all of them, unfortunately, so we'll get there eventually. I'm not too worried.
All right, sounds good. As for me this week, as I highlighted, I am still maintaining my position on the high scores of 5 minute and 31 second gap in between. So I'm not going back to solo Zamorak anytime soon, but I've been actually hitting the Yak Track kind of hard, and I'm not actually sure if I'm going to make this one. Because the skill and kills at the tail end are atrocious in terms of the amount of time they take. I just did a string of, I think, 5 tasks that wound up involving marks of war, archaeology, prayer bearing, and whatnot, which are the easy ones. And then now we're at kill 2,500 monsters.
Mm.
So that one's going to be a skill and kill.
Bring Karoming down to the Lumber's Catacombs.
Yeah.
You'll be done in an hour or two.
Yeah, I think that'll be quicker than delving into the skill and kill side of it, but we'll see if I make it. I plan to. I've made pretty much every Yak track, I think, except for the first one, so I plan to keep it that way.
I'm okay with people not finishing these, for the record. The Yak tracks? Like, a battle pass should go the entire duration, so...
That's true.
I feel fine about it, actually. Yeah. Like, I feel good about
and,
it.
And, I mean, as long as you get the rewards that you want, right? Like the hot tub resting animation.
I would have loved the bow at rank 49, but there's no shot.
No. Aye. But aside from that, just dailies, raids every so often, and just some skilling on the side to supplement the Yak Track stuff. But that's just kind of the phase I'm in, if you can tell. Kind of still waiting for that next big goal, that next big, next big turn the corner kind of thing. So, but... In any case, I think that wraps this episode of Update. I don't think there's anything else we have to go over. I'll just say again that the show is available on all podcast listeners out there. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, Pocket Casts, Amazon, Stitcher, and of course YouTube at youtube.com/RSBNB. You guys really like the nibbles we put out on the... on the rings and the robes of all things for the Zabarak week, which was a shock to me of all things. But hey, I mean, I guess that's
rewards.
That was what people were after for that one. But nonetheless, update.show/subscribe. Just subscribe on any podcast listener if you want the show automatically delivered to you. Or if your client gives you an opportunity to leave a review, do that. That helps us as well, as does a like and subscribe. But so great to have you back, Tanis. Thank you.
Thank you, Shane.
And of course, also Thaxi, for allowing us to go into one of my favorite pieces of content now, MASCAB raids, and look back at it with the modern lens of RSBNB Update compared to where we were at in 2015. So thank you for being here.
Absolutely.
And with that being said, we'll see you guys next week for another episode of RSBNB Update.
Ciao.
See ya.